There are 163 endangered Mexican gray wolves left in the wild in the U.S., and the agency responsible for their recovery isn't doing enough to save them, plain and simple. Several years ago, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services went against the best available science and developed new rules for Mexican gray wolves that inhibited their recovery, including deeming the only wild population of these gray wolves non-essential. And being an essential species is everything. It's the game changer. And placing an arbitrary cap on their numbers and habitat range. We need to take action today. Stay with me to learn what you can do to get involved and make a difference. Hi, everyone. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Impact Earth Wildlife. And we are going to be talking about those 163 Mexican gray wolves and finding out if there really is a road to recovery. And our guest is going to be absolutely frank with me about that. And for anybody who's been a part of my world for a while, you are probably well aware of my obsessions with wolves. And obsession is not an exaggeration at all. I have read just about every book I can get my hands on about wolves, including two books by a woman named Brenda Peterson that kind of started me on this path quite a while ago. And one of them is called Wolf Nation, which provided me with enough research to clearly understand their contribution to a healthy, balanced environment and why they should be an essential species. They are an essential species. I've spent time with one of the world's most renowned wolf experts, Rick McIntyre in Yellowstone, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and going to spend time with the wolf whisperers. And I have spent hours watching them in Yellowstone. So you can imagine how excited I am to finally have our guest with me for this next hour. I met him several months ago. His name is Craig Miller, and he is the Senior Southwest Representative for Defenders of Wildlife, one of the nation's leading protectors of this essential species. And I want to share with you a bit more about Craig's background and experience, just to give you a sense of the depth and breadth of his knowledge about all we plan to talk about on the show. He's been active in Southwest wildlife and wildlands protection since 1988, with an emphasis on Mexican gray wolf recovery. As the Senior Southwest Representative for Defenders of Wildlife, a national wildlife conservation organization, which I hope all of you know about already, he has been developing and implementing regional wildlife and habitat conservation programs since 1993. He is also the co-founder of the Northern Jaguar Project, a bi-national initiative to conserve jaguars throughout their northern range, where he served as president for that organization for 12 years. Prior to joining Defenders, he worked as an environmental consultant, outdoor adventure guide, wilderness study area adopter, and a wolf advocate for Preserve Arizona's Wolves, the first citizen group focused on returning endangered Mexican gray wolves to their historic home in Arizona. In other words, they were here first. So, Craig, I really am thrilled to have you here, and you know that. I kind of pounced on you when I met you and Erica introduced me because you do know so much about it. And I have spent an embarrassing number of hours looking for them in Northeast Arizona. I think I told you that. Like, not just hours, days, trying to see a Mexican gray up in the, Springerville, that area around Greer and Reserve in New Mexico, and so far, no luck. So I'm thrilled to have you here, and thanks for spending the time with us.
Well, thank you. I am delighted and honored to be a part of your show, and I will extend an invitation to you to go exploring wolf country anytime.
We have to do it. Like, we really have to do it. I don't have a bucket list because I'm going to live forever, but it's on the top of my list of things I have to do. And what I'd like to do for this time we spend together is talk about the good news, the bad news, and why there is such an urgent need for action. It's June 12th, the day this podcast will be released, and we have till June 15th to get to get engaged. And you can make a lot of difference in 10 or 15 days. And I'd like to add my own commentary about what I hope we can accomplish at the end of this podcast. In other words, beginning with the end in mind. I would like to give everyone a sense of where we are now, how critical it is for every person who listens around the country and in the Southwest to be so inspired that they couldn't even contemplate not doing anything. So that's all on you, Craig, to inspire us. No pressure. And then I hope we can take it a step further by asking our very loyal and engaged tribe to get others engaged, put it on their social media, send emails, do whatever we can, because our voices will matter. So let's get started with you, and I will be the really very present listener. Why don't we start with a brief background of the wolves, which to me is just fascinating. And just do that, and then we'll talk about the good news.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned earlier, this is an extremely rare form of life, Mexican gray wolves. They are the rarest gray wolf in the world. They have roamed what we call the American Southwest for the last 40,000 years, helping to shape and maintain the landscape that we love and now manage. As a result of conflicts with livestock beginning in the late 1800s and through the middle of the last century, those Mexican gray wolves were eliminated from the landscape by means of trapping, poisoning, both private and eventually a public campaign. And they were completely eradicated from the United States, with just a handful remaining in Mexico by the late 1970s and early 1980. The last five Mexican gray wolves were live captured in the wild in Mexico and brought into captivity to prevent them from extinction. The Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum here in Tucson and the Wild Canid Survival and Research Center in Missouri, which incidentally was started by Marlon Perkins and his wife, Carol Perkins.
Oh my God, I so remember him. I remember Marlon Perkins. I never missed it. Mutual of Omaha.
Yeah, well, you know, that show, Wild Kingdom, was really an inspiration for me as a young guy. You know, my grandfather and I would watch that religiously. And so the history of this program sort of resonates with me all the way back to childhood. But, you know, let's dive in on Marlon for just a moment. You know, here's a guy who educated and inspired, you know, tens of thousands, if not millions of people to become more aware of the plight of wildlife and the habitats and the impact that human society and livestock grazing and industrial practices are having on bears and lions and jaguars and wolves and the habitat that supports them. And he traveled the globe documenting the demise of wildlife populations and ecosystems through creative and fun storytelling. And some of it was fanciful, but entertaining nonetheless, and cared so deeply about wolves that in his retirement, he joined forces with his wife and founded the Wild Canid Research and Survival Center after he retired as the director of the St. Louis Zoo. And that was dedicated to preserve hope for gray wolf conservation. And shortly after the last handful of wolves were live captured in Mexico after they'd been eliminated in the United States. And the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum housed a few of those wolves. And over time, other individuals would learn of the plight of Mexican gray wolves, and other captive facilities would come on board and participate in intensively managing this really small and genetically threatened population to prevent extinction and to preserve the opportunity for eventual repatriation into the wild. Today, there are about 50 captive facilities between the U.S. and Mexico, managing about 300 individual wolves, primarily to preserve the taxon, the unique form of life, and their genetics to ensure that they don't wink out, and to support ongoing efforts at reintroducing those wolves to the wild in Arizona, New Mexico, northern Mexico, and hopefully other areas.
Well,
I got sidetracked on Marlon Perkins because I think that speaks to the significance of this issue. And it's not just an issue, but for crying out loud, we got down to one female remaining in the wild. You can't get closer to extinction than having one female remaining on the landscape. And people like Marlon and Carol Perkins and Bill Wooden and others, the director of the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum in its early years, had the foresight to intervene and take steps to preserve the opportunity for later generations to right the wrongs of the past. And that's what this program is in part attempting to do. And so bringing it up to date, you know, we worked on a program in the beginning in the late 1980s through a group called Preserve Arizona's Wolves, all volunteer citizens-based initiative to educate and motivate the public and the state and federal agencies to move forward with plans to reintroduce Mexican gray wolves, including a variety of activities. You know, for years, we conducted howling surveys along the U.S.-Mexico border to determine whether or not any individual wolves might remain because they're so genetically imperiled. Any survivors would be really invaluable to the captive program. Coordinating between the captive facilities to make sure that the animals that are held would be prepared for eventual repatriation to the wild. That means minimizing interactions with humans, maintaining their fear of feeding native prey, keeping animals off exhibit, et cetera. And then going through the whole public process. And I fortunately was able to begin working with Defenders of Wildlife in the late in 1992, actually prior to Wolf Reintroduction Yellowstone. I worked on the Yellowstone campaign there at Artist Point. We had a house that we rented in West Yellowstone, and groups of volunteers would come and stay for weeks at a time to help with a public education and advocacy campaign to support eventual reintroduction into Yellowstone. And we would use that as a template for an advocacy effort in the Southwest. But that campaign, the massive public education advocacy campaign was unfolding in the Southwest through Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas while the federal agencies were developing proposals for reintroduction, which began in 1998. After much court intervention, Fish and Wildlife Service moved forward with releases. The first year, 11 wolves in three family groups were released into Arizona. And that was sort of the next chapter in Mexican wolf restoration. So we're 22 years into the program now. And we have documented about 163, a minimum of 163 wolves at the end of 2019. And that is bittersweet news. And maybe we can talk about that in more depth in a little bit. But there's a lot of good, and there are still some significant challenges that need to be addressed, as you mentioned in your prelude. And I'd like to get to that maybe towards the end of our discussion about how we can act now to put this program back on track and ensure that the last 4 years of collaboration result in ecologically meaningful and sustainable recovery for one of the rarest land mammals in the world.
So I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I think I could end up being one doing this for the past 12 years. But, and this is off script, it was not something I planned to bring up, but your story got me there. When I read Brenda Peterson's book, Wolf Nation, I remember we were driving in the car and I was reading it. It was a long trip, maybe our 10-hour trip to Taos. And I'm not exaggerating. I was crying so hard that I couldn't talk, reading about how wolves are treated by organizations that are hard to find within the federal government, like Wildlife Services. And my question to you, and I don't know where the right place in the interview or the discussion is to ask you, I don't understand why they are among the most controversial wildlife management issues in the world. Why are they so vilified and misunderstood? And there's so much misinformation about there. And I told you off air that I got to be friends with Scotty Johnson, who worked for Defenders. And we used to meet for 2 to 3 hours in my studio downtown at Hotel Congress. And he was my storyteller about wolves and their history and why they're vilified. And have you come up with a good answer for that? Because I know that predation is not an issue, that far more calves are lost in cattle guards and freezing and all of the other things. So what have you come to terms with in terms of being able to answer that question? Why is there so much controversial when they are among the most magnificent, amazing, and essential species on the planet, if you ask me? Oh, there's a question.
There's a lot to unpack there. But if you've been talking with Scotty, I'm sure he's unpacked a lot of it.
He has.
Yeah. So, you know, I think in a very general sense, the root of the problem and the root of many of our problems today is the commodification of nature. You know, when we sort of moved to an agriculture-based society, the relationship between wolves and humans changed significantly. You know, prior to agriculture, you know, wolves and humans lived for quite a long time in relative harmony. And of course, I think all your listeners recognize that the domestic dog, you know, aka man's best friend, comes from wolves and
right.
The domestication of wolves, which was made possible by living closely with wolves. You know, humans, in many respects, reflect wolf society. And I've read quite a few things that are very, from my perspective, very human-centered, kind of focused on, you know, how wolves benefited from the presence of humans, and therefore, you know, they would move into camps. They'd over time increase their comfort level being around people, and you know, it made life easier. But fail to recognize how living in close proximity to wolves benefited human society. You know, by learning to hunt together more efficiently, and by observing the close, tight-knit family structure of wolf packs and how both the parents and the aunts and the uncles play a role in raising the young and establishing and defending territories and constantly coursing the landscape, looking for the next meal, assisting with the hunting, and on, are many characteristics of wolf society that also exist in human society. And who's to say for sure who taught who, but the fact of the matter is we have a lot in common. And it wasn't really until we made the switch to an agriculture-based society and the subsequent commodification of nature and resources that we really came into direct conflict with wolves. You know, they were no longer our hunting assistant or hunting partner, but became our adversary and posed a direct threat, particularly when we domesticated livestock. And, you know, a cow presents an opportunity for a much easier meal, you know, than a healthy, you know, bull, elk, yeah. Or, you know, pick your prey item.
True.
But it was that commodification and attaching a monetary value to what was the wolves' native prey that I think really was the beginning of the end for gray wolves.
But we're going to bring them back totally. So,
Yeah, well, things will change, you know. I think nature has a sort of self-correcting dynamic. And this actually was really brought home by Thomas Friedman, you know, a New York Times columnist,
yes,
recently, where he describes the COVID-19 pandemic in terms of our relationship to nature, you know, and his point is, you know, nature does not discriminate, and it's the entire world right now is being confronted by the same challenge. Nature does not discriminate,
right?
But those societies that will survive are those that are based on humility and respect for nature, and who value coordination as opposed to just competition and dominance, and also respect and employ science. And right now, you know, our national leadership violates all three of those
totally
values. You know, our market-driven and markets first and individual freedom first approach to everything is misguided. It's uninformed. It's selfish. It's utterly irresponsible. It's unsustainable, and it's dangerous. And I can't help but draw the parallels between, you know, the current pandemic and sort of our broader relationship with nature, as embodied in, you know, the history of wolf conservation, wolf eradication, and now efforts to reconcile our conflicts and share the landscape with, you know, one of the most misunderstood and ecologically valuable and important forms of life. We have a lot to learn. And I would be happy to share some stories about how we are learning how to work better together. You know, the wolf is presenting us with an opportunity to grow, to improve, to evolve as a society and as cohabitants.
I would love you to share some of that, because in my reading, there isn't just a good guy and a bad guy. I really learned that in the books that I read. There is coexistence with ranchers and farmers. And of course, I'm totally biased, but their willingness to engage in programs that are mutually beneficial and conflict reduction and resolution. And I've watched so many YouTube videos and really gone on the journey of what I would call having hope and having some good news. I have a thimbleful of knowledge compared to you, but I don't feel really great about 163 wolves in 42 packs. I'd be happy if it was like 600, because to me, that's still such a fragile population, but it's better than five. That's what I have to look at. So tell us, give us a good story. I know that a lot of the wolves are out in the White Mountain Apache tribe. We just went up to Greer about 3 weeks ago and went through there. So tell us some good news stories. This is a good news part of the show. Give us hope.
Yeah, well, since you brought up the White Mountain Apache tribe, they have been tremendous leaders in the Mexican wolf restoration effort. They weren't always on board with wolf reintroduction. You know, they came on board, I believe, in 2003. As I mentioned, the initial reintroductions began in 1998. And I had met with a couple of administrators at the tribe and their wildlife and range departments early on to talk about the wolf program and why we felt it was important, and to identify, you know, potential ways that we might be able to work together. This is pre-wolf on the reservation. And there were a couple of tribal members who really took a keen interest and initiated their own version of a NEPA process, and what we call a National Environmental Policy Act, complete with public hearings and proposed rules and, you know, all kinds of processes. The tribe undertook their version of a NEPA process, and they held just community meetings and talked about the wolf issue. And it's very organic and very consensus-based and self-directed. And the tribe rose to the challenge and decided they wanted to be part of the program. And we were more than excited to work in partnership with various tribal leaders to help provide tools or support training opportunities and eventually support them developing programs where they may benefit from the presence of wolves. And that's taken many forms over the years. One story that's kind of fun is, you know, the Honda Casino
yep.
is what the word is most recognized for. But the word Honda in Apache means welcome. And years ago, the tribe's casino agreed to sponsor one of the initial pack releases on tribal land. And to help make preparations for that, Defenders of Wildlife, my organization, agreed to help with supplies and equipment. They were going to build a pre-release facility. And, you know, I have conflicted feelings about off-road vehicles and quads, but in this case, one was necessary to help both get materials out into a remote part of the reservation to build an enclosure for a soft release where wolves would be held for several weeks prior to the eventual gate being open and turned out into the wild so they could acclimate to their new surroundings, and to remove livestock carcasses that may have died for other reasons, or to haul in native prey for supplemental feeding, that sort of thing. In any case, Honda, in Japanese terms, is a motorcycle manufacturer. And we purchased a Honda Rancher. It's a 4x4, four-wheel drive, and had custom decals made up that used the Apache spelling of the word Honda. And instead of Rancher, we changed the decal to Bacho, which is the Apache word for wolf. And so we presented the Honda Bacho to the tribe during a sunrise ceremony, where many elders who, are, of course, continue to speak in Apache primarily, got it immediately. And it was really well received. Many smiles and really made for a warm welcoming for wolves coming back onto the reservation. Now, don't get me wrong. The tribe is very diverse and has very complex politics. And, you know, many tribal members are involved in the elk hunting and guiding business and had legitimate concerns about the impact that wolves may have on their activities and income. And the livestock associations, which really are made up of families, maybe 15 to 20 families per association, each family owning, you know, several head of cattle, had concerns about the impact. Very small, on a family scale, very small operations, but collectively pretty large, and it's spread across, you know, 1.6 million acres. So those are legitimate issues related to wolves that needed to be reconciled. And we've developed many partnerships and unexpected, unlikely friendships over the years that have resulted in, you know, members of the livestock associations getting hired as a wolf livestock conflict specialist to be available to monitor wolf locations and work with other tribal ranchers to either move cattle away from conflict-prone areas like den and rendezvous sites, or to coordinate locations of wolves so you can locate a calving pasture away from conflict-prone areas, et cetera, and to take other types of proactive measures, which, you know, we can discuss in more detail if you'd like. And then we worked with the tribe to initiate a tribal youth program, which employs 6 young tribal members each year to work as an employee for this during the summer months. So these older high school and younger college age tribal members are employed to work as part of the wolf team, working side by side with field biologists and veterinarians getting hands-on experience in radio collaring or tracking or conflict avoidance, community outreach, and sort of experimenting with potential careers in wildlife and natural resource management. And so the wolves are helping to derive a benefit on that front. We also were privileged to be a part of an initiative by the tribe to experiment with these wildlife and culture themed tours called Apache Wilderness Journeys, where non-tribal members would come visit for 4 or 5 days, get horseback tours of wolf country. Men would participate in a sweat. There'd be storytelling with elders. The women would share stories, doing, you know, traditional Apache activities like fry bread and bead making and making burden baskets and that sort of thing. And then hiking and looking for tracks and listening for wolf howls. And, you know, there's so many fun things that have happened around them that are I will never forget. One was during a sweat. We would have conversations during the break between the rounds, and during a sweat ceremony, the men would sing songs, a series of songs, and sweat, and just this unbearably hot and cramped quarters, and pray and bond. And during the breaks between the rounds, an elder shared with me that, you know, the one of the songs we just sang in the sweat was called the Horse Song, and he said, well, you know, long ago, it wasn't called the Horse Song. He said, I'm just remembering this is called the Wolf Song.
Oh, wow.
But we haven't had the wolf for so long. Yeah. And so the wolf is sort of stimulating a bit of a renaissance. I don't want to be overly dramatic because, you know, there's still a lot of concerns among the folks that I had referenced in the elk hunting and livestock community about wolves, but it has precipitated a bit of a renaissance where there's a renewed interest, particularly among younger tribal members, in Apache traditions and those particularly related to wolves and wildlife. And that combined with direct opportunities, meaningful opportunities to connect with the program through employment or by assisting with, you know, tracking and wolf monitoring and that sort of thing. It's really empowering. And I think it shines a light on a potential future for younger tribal members with that kind of an interest in a society where, you know, it's still struggling with high rates of unemployment and disenfranchisement and suicide and drugs and gangs and you name it. And so, you know, by working together on working with each other to resolve our differences, we're discovering more and more ways that we can help each other, you know, enrich in our lives and just make things better across the board.
And it keeps moving forward. And to me, that's like intergenerational, multi-generational, and the public-private partnerships, especially with the tribe. So to me, that's like really excellent news. And because time flies when we're having fun, I just want to let you know that the links that you sent us on your blog, like Hopes for Mexican Gray Wolves, will be on the show page when we release it so people can read that, because it will talk about project successes, the tribal youth program, some cool photos and journal excerpts. And then we'll also put a link to the really cute video about the wild Mexican gray wolf puppies, because who would not love to see that? Excuse me. I think I died and went to heaven. So
let me offer a footnote on that cute little puppy video. I didn't do it justice. So 9 years ago, during one of these pilot wolf tours on the reservation, we went out late at night. It was pitch black, and I was demonstrating what howling surveys looked like, because I had explained how we'd conducted them for years prior to reintroduction, and people had interest. And we went out. We're trying a howling survey, and it must have been 11:30, 12 o'clock at night, and I put a howl out. Not a response, another direction, not a response. Third howl out, And sure enough, we got a response and everyone just still and got shivers. This was, you know, 9 years ago on the reservation, way out near Maverick, you know, pretty wild landscape. And sure enough, the tribe was able to document a pack in that area, which would later be named the Maverick Pack, which is still running strong today. And getting back to the video, that video is from last season. Those are pups from the Maverick Pack on White Mountain Apache tribal lands.
It just makes me even more sad because one of these days I am going to see a wolf, like even in Yellowstone, you know, you see the wolves and Rick McIntyre knows the name of every one of them, the number actually, and when they were born and what pack they belong to. And, you know, if I'm not looking in his scope or one of the other wolf whisperer scopes, it's very hard to see them, even with my great Swarovski binoculars. But there's just an excitement that's indescribable to me in being able to do that. So let's briefly go over, you know, I love that we spent most of the show on the good news because there is a lot and there's more for people that want more, because we will have a bunch of links that you can spend a good hour or so going down the rabbit hole looking. So talk about what some of the bad is. Because we need to know that, because at the end of the show, I'm going to do an impassioned plea that everybody get inspired to act, because there are things we can do. So how bad is it? And am I going to be able to stand it?
Well, I'm pretty optimistic.
That's great.
Yeah. In high school, I was given a toy gun after graduation for being the most optimistic.
Go figure.
There certainly is good news, as you mentioned. I didn't really do justice in terms of what's happening on the ground, but the numbers have increased. Wolves have expanded their range. Fish and Wildlife Service recently proposed and adopted a new management rule for the program. And that's very problematic because although it did some good things, it significantly expanded the area where wolves would be allowed to both be translocated or released and allowed to disperse and recolonize. It caused some significant problems too. And those problems range from what's called the essential versus non-essential status. You mentioned this in your introduction.
Right.
But there's a lot behind those words. You know, there's a legal definition of essential versus non-essential regarding whether or not a wild population is considered essential to the long-term survival of the taxon, the subspecies or species or listed entity. From 1998 until today, Mexican gray wolves have been considered non-essential because they were well represented in captivity. And the thought was, you know, well, it's a hugely controversial issue. You know, the agencies believe that if they're non-essential, there'll be less resistance to the wolves because there'll be more so-called flexibility, meaning that wolves can be removed for conflicts with livestock. They can be shot if they're in the act of preying on livestock. The idea is that ranchers would then feel that they're able to adequately protect their interests and that sort of thing, and that would result in increased social tolerance. That hasn't really borne out. And in fact, what that non-essential status did was really tied the hands of the Fish and Wildlife Service, because what non-essential also does is prevents things like consultations with other federal agencies, in this case, the U.S. Forest Service, which manages, you know, 97% of wolf-occupied habitat in the wolf program.
Right.
And what that means is, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service is not able to consult with the agency about things like their livestock grazing program or the way that lion houndsmen from, you know, the northern Rockies who come down seasonally with their lion hounds and their bear hounds and course the forest are managed, which has resulted in unending conflicts with livestock and other forest uses. And the Forest Service, because wolves are considered non-essential, essentially has taken the position that it's not their responsibility. Any decision that they make, any management action they take, won't result in jeopardy to Mexican gray wolves because these wild wolves are considered non-essential based on, you know, this concession that was made early on. Well, that ignores the genetic status the degree of imperilment of the wild population. And in fact, today, many of the individuals in the wild population are not only essential to the long-term survival of the taxon, but they're irreplaceable. You can't recreate the genetic makeup of some of these individuals. They're so genetically valuable. And equally important, the entire population, including the captive population, has lost some of its genetic diversity since the beginning of the breeding program. But there's still significant genetic diversity in the wild population that's not expressed. I'm sorry, in the captive population. Let me say that over. There's still significant genetic diversity in the captive population that's not represented in the wild population. And politics of the states and livestock industry, and to some extent the hunting industry, have prevented the release of genetically essential adult wolves since 2014. That has resulted in an increase in inbreeding and a decrease in diversity in the wild population. So unless we can get genetic diversity from the captive population into the wild immediately, I'm afraid there won't be much of a future for this wild population. Now, there is a process called cross-fostering, which has been taking place since 2016, where captive-born pups are placed into the litters of wild-born packs. And those pups are then hopefully adopted and accepted by the breeding female and raised as a member of those pups. And that can provide some diversity into the wild population. But the concern is, I think, merited in that it's a new experimental approach. Wolves don't breed until they're at least 2 years old. There's a fairly high rate of mortality in the wild population. And the stars pretty much have to align before you can successfully get captive pups into the wild population. That said, you know, there have been a few that have survived to breeding age. But at this point, we can't quantify how many or to what extent that's affected the genetics of the wild population. And this is too important of an initiative. The wolves themselves are too important to risk gambling on an as yet unproven methodology. So we really need to get genetically valuable animals into the wild as soon as possible. We really need the essential designation so that the Forest Service can provide guidelines to public lands ranchers who are grazing their livestock on public lands. To date, do not receive guidance from the Forest Service about relatively easy to adopt management protocols that could significantly reduce the vulnerability of cows to wolves. In fact, in some cases, we've had wolves on forest allotments, grazing allotments, for 18 years now, and there have been repeated conflicts, including removals of wolves and lethal removals, and those allotments still don't even mention the presence of wolves to the permittees. Every year, the Forest Service issues instructions to the forest, to each forest permittee regarding their grazing allotment, and it might identify things like streamside vegetation or stocking density, or in the case of Mexican spotted owls, because they're not considered non-essential. It would provide some reprieve for the owls during certain times of the year. But wolves in many cases aren't even mentioned, despite the fact that they've been on these very pastures for 18 years. So essential would change that. It would require the Forest Service to provide some guidelines. Simple things like, you know, dispose of your carcasses. Livestock die for a variety of reasons, you know, shipping fever, calving complications, noxious weeds, etc. By far more than what wolves are responsible for. But they're not required. Ranchers are not required to address those carcasses, either remove them or render them inedible. They could condense calving season. In many places in the Southwest, ranchers raise their livestock in a way where they're calving year-round. They just let the bulls run free and they breed at will. And therefore, calves are dropped in unpredictable places across the land, and it makes it difficult to impossible to actively manage. I mean, most livestock are lost during the first few months of their lives as calves. And by consolidating or condensing calving season to a couple of months, which is a very prudent management practice, and it actually could help improve overall productivity of an operation because it increases accountability and helps you get a jump on other types of sickness and injuries and that sort of thing. But the Forest Service doesn't even provide, you know, that as guidance, and a variety of other things could help improve the situation.
Guidance 101.
Dramatically. Exactly.
You don't want to get me started on why certain groups think they own the Forest Service land. It's really not theirs. They lease it for what I would call non-essential amounts, insignificant amounts. And the other part that we really don't have time to cover, but I'm hoping that we can whet people's appetites enough to know, including listening to some of our other podcasts, is wolves are an essential species. And all you have to do to prove that to yourself is look at the research, the data, the scientific records of what happened once wolves were reintroduced in Yellowstone. It's undeniable. The pictures don't lie. The science doesn't lie. The facts are there. And I come from a family of hunters, and I know what happens. I'm from New Jersey, and what happened when the natural predators disappeared in New Jersey for deer? It's not pretty there. Deer are like flies. I mean, seriously, they're all over. They invade people's gardens and lawns, and it's an imbalance of nature. And what wolves do is put in that natural balance back, and the elk population is healthier, and all the other populations down the food chain are there. So, you know, that's a story for another day, but there's so much that can be done, and so many examples of education works, and partnerships can be formed with the ranchers in many ways. Successfully, it happens. So we have to kind of get onto the next level of this, which is, what do we do? Lead us, guide us, tell us. Literally, this podcast comes out on June 2nd, and the closing of the comment period is June 15th. So 13 days for people to be inspired to act. And some people don't listen to my podcast for days after because it's in their podcast feed. So what is the big call to action?
Well, the call to action is to weigh in on the rulemaking process. We recently went to court and challenged the rule managing the Mexican wolf program, and the judge agreed with us on virtually every issue. Basically, she said the agency is not doing enough, and their actions won't lead to the recovery of wolves. Their actions, the decisions are not based on the best available science. And in fact, it goes beyond that, saying it's not just a disagreement among scientists, but they flatly ignored the findings and recommendations of the very respected scientists they originally recruited to help develop the recovery plan. And two other quick points, you know, that those scientists said, to ensure the wolves' future, you need to have at least 750 individuals distributed across three subpopulations, and they need to have genetic interchange. They need to have what they call effective migration once every 7 years to ward off against inbreeding and the island effect. And the other thing is the issue of boundaries. You know, that some of the best places remaining in Western United States are the Grand Canyon ecoregion and the area between northern New Mexico and southern Colorado. And the Grand Canyon area alone offers over 40,000 square miles of suitable habitat that's largely free of conflicts. Much of that lies within either protected national parks or national forests, with far fewer livestock permittees than there are in the current wolf country. And several of those permittees, the Grand Canyon Trust and the Babbitt Ranches, are not opposed to wolf recovery. So getting rid of the boundaries, this is one of the few endangered species that has boundaries imposed on them. And given its degree of endangerment, it's ridiculous to prescribe these politically motivated boundaries to keep them out of areas that both they need to survive and which house ecosystems that would benefit from their return. And then finally, you know, the agency instead of increasing protections for wolves, relax the rules for allowable take. It makes it easier to trap and kill them. And so to help address that, we've put together an action page. As you mentioned, it'll be on your site, and I will say it real quickly. It's dfnd.us/mgw10jaction. And believe it or not, I did ask our IT folks to come up with a really easy word that we could use so that I could deliver this web address verbally, and that's the best we could do. dfnd.us.
Well, I loved it because I thought it was for Mrs. Green's World, so I was thrilled. it will be there, but it's defend.us/mgw10jaction. And please, everybody, do it. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, with our team, we are beyond the point of having our mission to be raise awareness about the impact of climate change. Okay. And it's all part of the same conversation. We're to the point of asking people to get engaged because we don't engage with climate deniers. We don't even acknowledge them because what's the point? There's no cheese down that tunnel, as we say. So the people that are either on the fence or looking for things to do, that's who our audience is, people that want to act now to do the right thing, the good thing for ourselves and for the planet, because we all benefit from this in our natural areas. So I'm just a total nut job when it comes to the wolves, and I admit it. But it comes from a really good place of education and research. I didn't just wake up one day and say, wow, the wolves are really important. If you read, I keep saying, Brenda Peterson's book, because if that doesn't grip you, I don't know what does. I bought 10 copies and I gave it to the people that do our website when Scotty and I were meeting to try to get funding for a series. And the founder, one of the founders, partners of Brink Media in Tucson, called me and said, you're right, I had to stop reading it and put it down and then pick it up again and put it down, because it raises awareness front and center about how we have treated wolves as a species. And it did make me sick and sad and insane for a little bit. And I think there's people that would question if I've come back from the insanity. So it will be a plea to act now. And I want to have the last word and wonder about what can I say. I've said it all. Craig, you've given us such great information and history. And I can say that in the 12 years of my role as Mrs. Green's World and an environmental educator, rarely, if ever, has a single species and their survival captivated me and pulled me in and literally stolen my heart as much as wolves. And the Mexican gray are part of that. I live here in Arizona. So first and foremost, and then, like I said, the Mexican grays have first place and all wolves come in a close second to me. And I just want to say to our wonderful tribe, if you were ever inspired to take action on any issue, our time is now. Please take action on this one. Time is of the essence, 13 days from when the podcast is released. We need your voice, and your voice can make a difference. And we need the voices of the people you know and care about this great planet of ours and all of its inhabitants. So please let your voice be heard. All the links you need to do just that are on the show page for this podcast. So you are literally one click away. And I'm thanking you in advance for doing just that. And thank you, Craig, and Defenders of Wildlife, not just for how much you do on this single issue, but how much your agency continuously shows up to fight the good fight, investing in it, making good things happen, filing lawsuits, educating people. And that's my last word. And then my last thanks, as always, goes to our wonderful tribe for listening and for your overall support in general, because without you, there would be no us. So, Craig, I said I have the last word, but that was for me. Do you have any last words that you would like to add before we call this show complete?
I just want to thank you and your listeners. Your program is always inspiring, and thank you for that.
That's a really nice thing to say. And let's just get on record here, be on the air, that you promise me, kind of pinky swear, that we will maybe regroup in the fall and I'll come up and visit, because I am not exaggerating one bit when I say I just hope that I can manifest actually seeing a Mexican gray in my lifetime.
Well, I'd be happy to accompany you on that that adventure.
You know that I will not forget. Mm-hmm. So everybody, thanks for being a part of my world. Act now. You're one click away. And in this time of craziness and a crazy mixed up world, why would you not? You have time. We're sheltering at home, a lot of us, not having meetings out at the office. So there's never been a better time. And Craig, thanks for all you do, your tireless efforts. You have to see some of the pain and the carnage that's out there, and I do not envy you that. So thanks, everybody. Make it an intentionally lived green day. Thanks for being a part of my world.